Welcome to another episode of the Cognitive Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Jeremy Law. I am joined by my friend Karen to discuss the first part of our multi-part series on language. Okay, let's dive in. It's kind of amazing when you stop and think about it, how easily you understand what I'm saying right now.
Right, or how you just read text off a page. It feels completely effortless.
Yeah, exactly. But as researchers like Sophie Scott point out, there's actually this incredibly complex machinery working away under the hood, you know, unconsciously.
Absolutely. And that's what we're really digging into today, language comprehension. We'll be looking at both listening and reading.
We've pulled together some fascinating stuff from cognitive psychology, language acquisition research. And our goal really is to unpack the mechanics behind it all, how we make sense of words we hear or see.
Think of it as a shortcut to understanding this amazing cognitive feat, going beyond just, well, hearing sounds or seeing letters.
We want to reveal the challenges our brains are constantly overcoming.
It's quite the testament to our mental processing power.
So where do we start? Spoken language seems like the obvious place. It often feels like this continuous stream, right?
Yeah, like, could you pass the salt, please? It all runs together.
So how do we even find the words in that stream?
That's the first big hurdle, segmentation. We have to chop that continuous signal into meaningful chunks, into words. And usually there aren't neat little pauses between the words.
It's like finding spaces in one sentence. How does the brain manage?
Well, one idea is the possible word constraint. Basically, our brain tries to carve up the sound stream so that it results in actual words we know.
Okay. So like in that example, fill a green bucket works because fill, a green bucket, are all words.
Exactly. But if you tried to parse it as filigree on bucket, well, filigree is a word, bucket is a word, but you're left with this stray in sound.
Which isn't a word on its own in that context, so the brain rejects that segmentation.
It prefers the option that uses up all the sounds to make valid words. It's constantly optimizing for meaning.
Okay, that makes sense. But what about when the sounds themselves change? Like, how I say a word might be different from how you say it.
Right. That brings us to co-articulation. As we speak, our mouths are already getting ready for the next sound.
Anticipating.
Precisely. And that anticipation subtly changes how the current sound is produced. Sounds kind of bleed into each other. It's also called assimilation.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Think about the vowel in pass. Depending on your accent, maybe British versus American English, that a sound can be quite different.
Yet we usually understand it fine.
We do. And that's partly down to something called categorical perception.
Okay.
Even though there's a whole spectrum of slight variations in how someone might pronounce, say, a P sound versus a B sound, our brain tends to slot them neatly into one category or the other. We hear it as either P or B, not usually some ambiguous sound in between.
Like flipping a switch rather than turning a dial.
That's a great analogy, yes. It simplifies the input for us.
So we segment the stream, deal with sound variations, then we have to actually recognize the word itself. Yeah. Right? Which isn't just like looking it up in a dictionary.
Not at all. It's a very dynamic process. Research suggests it's not strictly linear sound processing, then word recognition, then sentence meaning.
It all interacts.
Yes. The acoustic information, identifying the word, what we call lexical access in the sentence context, all seem to influence each other pretty much simultaneously.
Context definitely feels important. You can sometimes figure out a word even if it's muffled.
Absolutely. And how and when context jumps in is a big debate. Does it influence our very first perception of the sounds or only help later to choose between word candidates?
Is there evidence for that early influence?
Yes, the phonemic restoration effect is a classic example. Warren and Warren did this study where they replaced a sound in a word, like the S in legislature, with a cough. Listeners often reported hearing the full word perfectly clearly. They didn't even notice the cough replaced the sound. Their brain just filled in the blank based on the context.
Wow. So our brain is actively predicting and patching things up.
It's using top-down knowledge to make sense of the bottom-up signal.
That's amazing. What about tracking eyes? I think I read about studies showing how we consider similar words.
Ah, yes. The visual world paradigm. Alapena and colleagues had people listen to instructions like pick up the beaker while tracking their eyes looking at different objects.
And what did they find?
When people heard beaker, their eyes didn't just go straight to the beaker. They also flickered towards things like a beetle.
Because it starts the same.
Exactly. Those are cohort competitors. And interestingly, they even looked briefly at things that rhymed, like a speaker.
So hearing the start of a word activates a whole bunch of candidates.
It seems so. Both words that start the same and, to a lesser extent, words that rhyme get temporarily activated. Though the beginning of the word seems most important.
What helps narrow it down then? Just hearing more of the word.
That's key, but other things matter too, like word frequency. Common words are recognized faster than rare words.
Makes sense. Anything else?
For reading, phonology, the sound structure plays a role even when you're reading silently. How so? Well, Hansen and others found that sentences that are hard to pronounce, like tongue twisters, actually take longer to read silently.
Really? Even silently?
Yeah, it suggests we have this inner voice that's sort of sounding out the words, engaging the phonological system.
Okay, and the spelling must matter too when reading.
Definitely. How consistently spelling maps to sound influences recognition speed. And think about words that look similar. Having lots of similar-looking words or friends can sometimes help, but sometimes enemies, words with unusual spelling patterns, can slow things down.
It's complex. And what about recognizing letters within words?
Ah, the word superiority effect. Letters are actually easier to identify when they're part of a real word compared to when they're alone or in a jumble of random letters like W-K-O-R.
So the word context helps us see the letters better.
Precisely. It all points to this interactive system.
Now, you mentioned models. Can we quickly touch on how some computational models try to capture this?
Sure. One major one is the trace model. Think of it as a network with different layers, features, phones, words. Information flows both ways. Bottom up from the sounds or letters, and top down from the word level back to the phone level.
So if it's truly interactive?
Yes. Activation spreads through the network. When you hear sounds, related phonemes get activated, which activate words containing them. But crucially, there's competition between activated words.
The best match wins out.
Essentially, yes. The word that gets the most activation from all sources, including context, becomes the one we recognize. Trace is good at explaining things like phonemic restoration and how we handle noisy or ambiguous input.
What's another key model? Especially for spoken words unfolding over time.
The cohort model is very influential there. The core idea is that as soon as you hear the beginning sounds of a word, you activate all the words in your mental lexicon that start with those sounds. This initial set is the cohort.
Okay, so beaker activates beaker, beetle, bean.
Right, and as you hear more sounds, say, the pick sound words that don't match, like bean, drop out of the cohort.
Until only one is left.
Exactly. You reach the uniqueness point where only one word matches the input heard so far. There's good brain imaging evidence using ERPs and MEG, supporting this idea of rapid narrowing down based on the uniqueness point.
So trace focuses on interaction, cohort on the time course, and narrowing down both highlight the complexity.
Definitely. Recognizing a single word is already a huge achievement.
Right. So let's scale up. How do we understand whole sentences is more than just stringing word meanings together?
Absolutely. We need to figure out the grammatical structure, who did what to whom. That's sentence parsing.
And sometimes our first guess is wrong. Those garden path sentences.
Exactly. They lead you down the garden path to the wrong interpretation initially.
Like, while the man hunted, the deer ran through the woods. You first think the man hunted the deer.
But then ran doesn't fit. You have to backtrack and realize the deer was the one running while the man hunted.
My brain definitely stumbles there. I have to reread.
And that's what Schotter's research showed. If you prevent people from looking back at earlier parts of a garden path sentence, comprehension really suffers. We rely on that ability to revise our initial parse.
Okay, so rereading helps fix parsing mistakes.
Mm.
What helps us get it right the first time when we're listening?
Prosody is a massive help in spoken language. The rhythm, the pitch changes, the pauses.
That music of speech.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
Where you pause or emphasize words can totally change the structure and meaning. Think about, woman without her man is nothing. Where did the pauses go?
Changes the meaning completely.
Research clearly shows we use these prosodic cues to figure out how words group together grammatically.
What about silent reading, then? We don't have audible pauses or intonation.
True, but the implicit prosody hypothesis suggests we create our own internal version.
Our inner voice adds the punctuation.
Sort of, yes. Fodor proposed that as we read, we activate prosodic contours mentally, and there's evidence for it. Brain responses to commas in reading look similar to brain responses to actual pauses in listening.
Wow, that's cool. So we mentally hear the structure.
Mm.
Are there models for parsing too?
Yes, several. One early one is the garden path model. It basically says we build the simplest possible structure first, following principles like minimal attachment.
Attach new words simply.
Right. And late closure attached to the phrase currently being processed. It's efficient, but sometimes leads us astray, hence the garden path effect. Its limitation is that it assumes this initial parse is quite rigid.
What's a more flexible alternative?
The constraint-based model. This argues we use all available information syntax, word meaning, context, world knowledge right from the start.
So multiple constraints guide the interpretation simultaneously.
Exactly. Our brain weighs all the evidence probabilistically to find the most likely structure. Things like verb bias, the fact that certain verbs typically appear in specific structures, act as constraints.
So it's less about simple rules, more about weighing evidence.
Yes. And then there's the unrestricted race model, which suggests multiple structures are built in parallel.
And they race.
Kind of. The one that gets built fastest or reaches an activation threshold first becomes the initial interpretation.
Okay, so different views on how we build sentence structure. Now moving beyond single sentences, paragraphs, stories.
Right, text comprehension. Yeah. A huge part of this is making inferences.
Fill in the gaps.
Precisely. Information that isn't explicitly stated, but that we derive to make sense of the text.
Like that classic example, Mary heard the ice cream van. She remembered her pocket money. She rushed into the house.
We instantly infer she wants ice cream and is going to get money, even though it's not stated.
Are there different kinds of inferences?
Oh, yes. Bridging inferences connect sentences, like figuring out who she refers to. Elaborative inferences add world knowledge. We might even make predictive inferences about what happens next.
And some are automatic, some take effort.
Seems so. Factors like your working memory capacity can influence how easily you draw complex inferences. Even stereotypes about who is speaking can affect the inferences we draw.
That's fascinating. What else helps us understand bigger chunks of text?
Schemas. Yes, schemas. These are like our mental scripts or knowledge structures about typical situations or concepts.
Like having a restaurant schema, knowing the sequence of ordering, eating, paying.
Exactly. Bransford and Johnson's washing clothes study showed this powerfully. People understood a vague passage much better if they were told beforehand it was about washing clothes. It activated the relevant schema.
So, schemas provide a framework for comprehension.
They do. Brain imaging suggests the ventromedial prefrontal cortex is involved, though defining precisely what counts as a schema can sometimes be tricky.
Got it. Okay. One last big area. Sometimes the literal meaning isn't the intended meaning.
Ah, pragmatics. Understanding language and context, figuring out speaker intention.
Like sarcasm or indirect requests.
Exactly. Philosopher Paul Grice's ideas are key here. He proposed the cooperative principle. We assume speakers are trying to be cooperative, truthful, informative, relevant, and clear.
His maxims, right? Quantity, quality, relation, manner.
Those are the ones. And when someone seems to violate a maxim, we don't just assume they're being uncooperative. Instead, we infer an underlying meaning, a conversational implicature.
So if I ask, are you going to the party? Mm-hmm. And you say, I have to work. I infer you're not going because work prevents it, even though you didn't explicitly say no.
Perfect example. You infer the relevant meaning. More recent frameworks like the Rational Speech Act model or relevance theory build on these ideas, looking at how we reason about speakers' intentions and knowledge.
It also involves figuring out what the speaker thinks we know, right?
Common ground, the shared knowledge between participants is crucial. We tailor what we say based on what we assume the other person knows. The research shows we sometimes overestimate this shared knowledge.
So, wow. From slicing up sounds to recognizing words against competitors, parsing sentences, drawing inferences using schemas, understanding intentions.
It's an incredibly complex cascade of processes.
And yet most of the time it just happens effortlessly.
The efficiency is staggering. Our brains are constantly handling ambiguity, filling gaps, and integrating knowledge. It's remarkable.
It really is. And it makes you wonder if these language comprehension processes are so intricate, could subtle changes in how well we perform them tell us something deeper?
That's a really interesting thought.
You know, maybe about other cognitive functions, or even thinking about research on language production changes in conditions like mild cognitive impairment. Could subtle comprehension shifts also be early signals?
It's certainly plausible that these highly demanding processes might be sensitive indicators.
Yikes.
It gives you a new perspective on just talking or reading, doesn't it?
It really does. A whole new appreciation for the hidden work our brain is doing constantly.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground, but honestly, this is just scratching the surface of language comprehension research.
Absolutely. There's so much more out there if this has sparked your interest.
We hope it has.
Definitely. Let us know what you thought. Any aha moments or questions this brought up for you?
We'd love to. And join us next time as we can tie you our chat about language in another episode of the Cognition Podcast.